Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The 20th century may be the last for great literary letter writers. Virginia Woolf and D.H. Lawrence, John Cheever and Flannery O'Connor, they didn't tweet, they didn't email. Now come the letters of the great Saul Bellow. He won his readers with The Adventures of Augie March, Seize the Day, Henderson the Rain King, Humboldt's Gift, and the prizes he won, the Nobel Prize, the Pulitzer. This hour On Point, the letters of writer and novelist and exuberance, Saul Bellow. Joining me now from New York is Benjamin Taylor, award-winning novelist and essayist and editor of a large and revealing new collection of Saul Bellow's lifetime of correspondence. It's called Saul Bellow, Letters. Benjamin Taylor, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom Ashbrook. Happy to be here.
Remind us of Saul Bellow. We will have listeners who read every book, every novel he ever put out, and essays and short stories to boot. And we'll have others who are younger, who may have had them in a class at this point in college, who may not have. Give us a profile of this great 20th century writer.
Saul Bellow was born in a Jewish slum outside of Montreal, in a town called Lachine, Quebec. At the age of 8, his family immigrated illegally to Chicago, where his father worked in various kinds of businesses, some of them strange businesses. The family made an increasingly secure home in Chicago, and Bellow attended the University of Chicago, attended Northwestern, and then went on to the University of Wisconsin, where he thought he wanted to be an anthropologist. All his anthropological papers kept turning into stories, though. At that point, he realized he wasn't going to be an anthropologist. He was going to be a novelist and a story writer, and he never looked back after that.
And talk about Saul Bellow as a writer, just an amazing writer. I remember opening up his books for the first time in the 1970s and just being so thrilled with the exuberance in here. The mind, the philosopher, the intellectual, but the comedy and the picaresque and the joy in these novels.
Yes. Well, when you look for comparisons, you have to think in terms of writers who brought a whole new style to completion in the course of their work. Joyce comes to mind. Beckett comes to mind. Bellow, very different from those two, could best be described that way also. A whole new style. He had more language in him than any of his contemporaries. And I think if you want a point of comparison among the writers of his generation, perhaps you have to go to Nabokov.
Nabokov with a whole lot of zest added in, maybe, and you've got the beginnings of Saul Bellow. Who did he write to? What's you've got a couple of thousand letters that you've winnowed down to 700 or so. What's the range of his correspondence?
There are letters to friends of childhood, and those letters to the friends of childhood go on into old age, and I think they are among the most revealing. There are letters to wives and former wives and lovers. There are occasional letters, those I was able to come into possession of, to his sons. And perhaps most revealingly, there are the letters to fellow writers, as you've mentioned, to John Cheever, whom he ranked highest among his own contemporaries, to Philip Roth, whom I would say he ranked highest in the next generation, to William Kennedy, to Ralph Ellison, to a very large number, and to women writers too, to the late Alice Adams, for instance, number of very interesting letters to her. A very, very wide range of correspondence. You even find letters to Daniel Patrick Moynihan, for example.
Was he literary in his letter writing? Do you recognize Saul Bellow in the prose of his correspondence?
I do. I do recognize Saul Bellow in his letters, the Saul Bellow of the novels and the stories. What astounded me when I looked at the handwritten letters was that nothing was ever scratched out. It seemed to me that he was getting this marvelous idiom down on the first try. Whereas if you look at the manuscripts, the handwritten manuscripts of the novels, you see nothing but scratch outs. So these have to have been two very different processes. But there is a lot of the same music in the letters, I find.
He writes about correspondence and time with friends being an escape hatch from what he called the miserliness of private consciousness. Can you feel that going on, Benjamin?
Yes, he keeps talking in the letters about how he's lost the gift for letter writing. All the while, he goes on furiously producing letters. I think, like many writers, he was haunted by the reality of an aging writer's life, that you spend more and more time and perhaps finally nearly all your time at the desk thinking about invented people. The letters gave him access to real people from his past and his present.
He was so lauded. He won the National Medal of Arts, the Pulitzer Prize, won the National Book Award 3 times. He was the only writer to have been nominated for it 6 times. And, of course, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. This is a little scratchy, this recording, but here's some of Saul Bellow's speech upon receiving a little bit of it, receiving the Nobel Prize for Literature, 1976.
I feel that I have scarcely begun to master my trade. But I need not worry too much that all men will speak well of me. The civilized community agrees that there is no higher distinction than the Nobel Prize, but it agrees on little else. So I need not fear that the doom of universal approval is hanging over me.
Saul Bellow, with his acceptance speech of the Nobel Prize 1976, saying he doesn't need to fear the doom of universal approval. You've got a bit in the collected letters here, Benjamin Taylor, of a letter he wrote to a colleague after receiving the Nobel Prize, to Ralph Ross. Who was that? And give us a little read, if you would.
Ralph Ross was a much-loved teacher of English literature. He'd been Bellow's colleague at the University of Minnesota early on, even in the 40s and again in the 50s. And then in March of 1977, reflecting on the cyclone that passed through his life after winning the Nobel Prize, he wrote this. "Gives me great satisfaction to look back in detachment and to think of the wit the gods gave us when they had to reduce our scope. But why didn't they reduce our ambitions accordingly? We were fired up with glorious dreams of achievement leading to such appalling waste. No one could make a true success except a few private persons with limited aims. Some of us, trying hard, were wonderfully unstinting of themselves. I think of John Berryman, so generous in self-destruction, or Isaac Rosenfeld, who put on every stitch of virtue he had and got on his horse and jumped into the big hole in the Forum. No one who set out to make the big scene in a big way could, in the nature of the case, get very far." It's interesting, in the light of this, what he said the very morning that he learned he'd won the Nobel Prize. "The child in me is delighted," he said, "but the adult in me is skeptical."
But, of course, the child never goes away. I love that, the phrase about thinking of the wit the gods gave us when they had to reduce our scope. But why didn't they reduce our ambitions, according to
this?
What about Bellow's ambition in these letters? I mean, there are some very early on. He's talking to Ralph Ellison. He's been down in
Puerto Rico. He's not a made man, a made literary personage yet. Well, what about Bellow's ambition as it comes through in these letters?
No, there's an early letter to his English publisher, John Layman, a very distinguished man, a writer in his own right, in response to Layman's equivocal response to the early draft of The Adventures of Augie March. Mm-hmm. He says, look, I know what's being produced out there. I know this is something entirely new. If you don't want to publish it just as I've written it, send it back to me. This was extraordinary in a person who'd had so little recognition. He had an absolute certainty of his, not his election, but that his ambitions were not incommensurable with his gifts. He was tremendously sure of what he had in him, even before it was out onto the page, I think.
What's the measure of an artist in his or her letters? I mean, after all, it's the work that is their work. So here we come to their letters, and you know, are we judging? You had to exercise judgment in what to include, but do you judge an artist by their letters or simply by the
no.
word?
No, no, and they're not the first thing you ought to read either. There are novels and stories that anyone ought to read before reading the letters, but they do enable you to, as it were, turn the tapestry around and see the knotted, ragged backside of what was going on.
We'll hear in just a moment from fellow scholar Gloria Cronin a couple of calls for Susan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, I was a Saul Bellow student in his graduate seminar in the novel at Boston University in the 90s.
Yes.
And what I wanted to know was about his creative process. But in that seminar, he forbid us to discuss his novels. We discussed Nabokov and many other novelists. And I wonder if his letters reveal his process.
So he wouldn't let you up close, even though you were there to study with Saul Bellow? He wouldn't show you his own way, Susan?
No, he wouldn't, but he didn't. He refused to discuss his novels, but he did, to a certain extent, discuss life. So he let us up close in that way.
Susan, I appreciate your call. Benjamin Taylor, what about the creative process? In the letters, I don't know, to other writers, you must surely talk about it, write about it.
He was one of the master revisers of all time. At the Berg Collection of the New York Public Library, there is the bound galley of Mr. Samwer's Planet that Bellow corrected right down to the deadline. The galleys, as they went out, were in the end quite different, especially in the last pages from the finished book. I was fascinated to examine that and to see just how many of the best and most moving things in the last pages of that book were added at 11:59 p.m., as it were. So I would say that the process really never ended for him. He finally had to abandon works, but he was a fiendish reviser.
He says in these letters that he built his entire life around the writing. Does it surprise you, having read these, Ben, that he didn't want to go into his own work with his students?
No, that really doesn't surprise me at all. As I understand it, when he was teaching with James Wood, a seminar. This may have been the caller's seminar. Mm-hmm. Seize the Day was discussed, but on that day, Bellow absented himself from class.
Wow. Richard in Framingham, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
It's hard for me to think of a writer that had that was as big as Bellow.
Yeah.
When I was a little kid growing up, I grew up in Highland Park.
Highland Park in Chicago. Yeah, his turf.
Everybody had a copy of Herzog.
Yes.
And not only did they have a copy of Herzog, when I finally picked up my parents' copy, it had a copy of a sermon by our rabbi who had spoken on it. I can't think of, and then had bothered to actually have it printed and distributed. And I can't think of anybody who had that sort of impact where people actually felt compelled to discuss a modern writer from the pulpit like that.
Did you see him on the streets of Highland Park, or I don't know, did you cross paths with Saul Bellow, Richard?
Well, my first quarter at the University of Chicago, he won the Nobel Prize.
Wow.
And of course, you know, we were all very excited and we thought, oh great, he's going to talk to us. But he was around Hyde Park, he was notoriously misanthropic and refused to have anything to do with undergraduates. So that was the great disappointment of Bellow's Nobel Prize for us. On the other hand, I still have to say that reading Seize the Day compacts more emotional power into the shortest space of anything I've ever read.
Yeah, so. It's pretty incredible. And everybody there was carrying Herzog, you say. I've got a little bit of Saul Bellow reading from the opening. This is, of course, published in 1964. This is a 1989 recording from the opening of Herzog. Of course, it begins not in Chicago in this case, but in the Berkshire Hills in Massachusetts. Here's Saul Bellow reading in 1989.
It was the peak of summer in the Berkshires. Herzog was alone in the big old house. Normally particular about food, he now ate silver cup bread from the paper package, beans from the can, and American cheese. Now and then he picked raspberries in the overgrown garden, lifting up the thorny canes with absent-minded caution. As for sleep, he slept on a mattress without sheets. It was his abandoned marriage bed. Or in the hammock covered by his coat. Tall, bearded grass and locust and maple seedlings surrounded him in the yard. When he opened his eyes in the night, the stars were near like spiritual bodies. Fires, of course, gases, minerals, heat, atoms, but eloquent at 5 a.m. to a man lying in a hammock wrapped in his overcoat.
Saul Bellow, in 1989, reading his own Herzog. We're joined by Benjamin Taylor, editor of Saul Bellow Letters, a big collection, 700-plus Bellow letters just out. You can join us as well, 800-423-8255. And we're very happy to be joined right now from Provo, Utah, by Gloria Cronin. She's co-editor of the Saul Bellow Journal, professor of English at Brigham Young University, author of Conversations with Saul Bellow, Saul Bellow, A Mosaic, and many more. Gloria Cronin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
As a real student of Saul Bellow, when you look into his letters, what do you see there that's, you know, of a piece with the man we know from his literary work? And perhaps what do you see that's different or revealing in a different way?
Well, two things come to mind. Benjamin mentioned the inimitable voice, the remarkable Bellow voice that changed the face of contemporary Anglo-American literature.
And we just heard it there in Herzog. How do you define it? How do you describe it?
Well, it's that marvelous polyglot voice that comes from his experience in Lachine, speaking French, learning Hebrew, speaking Yiddish in the house, listening to Russian. Then he moves as a child to Northside Chicago, and there he is in the immigrant streets hearing every kind of European argot and having to learn American English on the street. And I think that the deep biblical resonances that James Wood has mentioned resonate all through the books. And, you know, that struck British writers like Ian McEwan particularly, and he changed English contemporary writing with that marvelous voice, and it's right there in the letters.
He describes himself here as a both a glacier and a volcano, sometimes as a bear who bites people's heads off when they cross him, but also, and there's this wonderful bit quoted here by Michiko Kakutani, saying describing himself feeling as like a creature that flies, though, quote, too heavy to be a bird, too sinful to be any sort of angel. I mean, he brings it all to his work. The letters as well, Gloria?
I think so. I mean, he makes a wonderful comment when telling somebody that he has been tardy in replying to a letter, and he says, well, the good intentions paving company blanked up this time. And you get that wonderful street argot, and then you've got wonderful meditations on the afterlife and hoping that he will see his parents again. You get literary allusions and smatterings of French, and they're witty and they're erudite and comic and tender and mean-spirited occasionally and quite fierce and quarrelsome. So the whole range is there. And I think to answer the second part of your question, I think what's so rich and lovely about this collection that Benjamin's put together is that you get this total range of voice, and it's the voice that comes through. And I would just suggest one thing to Benjamin, and that is letters are literary artifacts as well. And these are beautiful. They will attract a lot of scholarly attention as literary artifacts in their own right.
Benjamin Taylor, did you have that feeling going through the 2000 to find the 700? I'm also in the literary realm of Salbella.
Yes, there are some letters that seems to me qualify as works of art. There is a letter, for example, to John Cheever, written after he learned how ill Cheever was, ill and not going to get well. Shall I just read a passage from that?
Oh, yes, please.
This is dated December 9th, 1981, Chicago. Dear John, since we spoke on the phone, I've been thinking incessantly about you. Many things might be said, but I won't say them. You can probably do without them. What I would like to tell you is this. We didn't spend much time together, but there is a significant attachment between us. I suppose it's in part because we practiced the same self-taught trade. Let me try to say it better. We put our souls to the same kind of schooling. And it's this esoteric training which we had the gall, under the hostile stare of exoteric America, to persist in that brings us together. Yes, there are other deeper sympathies, but I'm too clumsy to get at them. Just now, I can offer only what's available. Neither of us had much use for the superficial given of social origins. In your origins, there were certain advantages. You were too decent to exploit them. Mine, I suppose, were only to be overcome, and I hadn't the slightest desire to molest myself that way. I was, however, in a position to observe the advantages of the advantaged, the moronic pride of WASPs, Southern traditionalists, etc. There wasn't a trace of that in you. You were engaged, as a writer should be, in transforming yourself. When I read your collected stories, I am moved to see the transformation taking place on the printed page. There's nothing that counts really except this transforming action of the soul. I loved you for this. I loved you anyway, but for this especially.
Wow. Salbella writing to John Cheever. That's December 9th, 1981, I see here.
Yes.
Gloria, what do you make of this interaction? I mean, that's a writer's letter to a writer, certainly.
It's a great man letter to a great man, too. And I think Bellow's letters do stand among those of Wolfe and Lawrence and O'Connor and so forth. Remarkable in this collection is a tender voice. There are tender letters to old friends from childhood. There are tender letters to ex-lovers. There are marvelous letters to a godchild and a grandchild. And mostly to these old friends, for whom he openly expresses love. These are love letters in many, many ways, even when he's quarreling with an editor or chiding a son or whatever it is that he's doing. They're comic and they're tender. The full range is there, from the witty to the erudite to the very tender. And then at the end, as he grows older, an extreme old age, you have these marvelous occult letters talking about the fact that he hopes he sees his parents in the afterlife and meditating about the afterlife. There's something sage-like and almost Talmudic about these. The laments of old age are even eloquent. And, of course, sad confessions of the loss of his prodigious memory, one of his great assets. That occult personality remains to the very end.
And the tenderness is absolutely wonderful. There's one, I think it was Cheever who asked if he'd like to see some new manuscript that he's prepared. And he says, well, you know, would I like to go to Xanadu with Helen of Troy and send it on? He can be tough, too, though. He writes about his first wife, you know, sort of ranting, you know, she wants money, 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 or failing money, blood. Benjamin, there's a very tough letter that he wrote to William Faulkner on the subject of Ezra Pound. Can you remind us of that one?
Well, yes, it had to do with the award of the first Bollingen Prize in poetry, which went to Ezra Pound, and this produced a tremendous hue and cry at the time. Faulkner... favoring it, and many people, I think a majority, favoring it. And Bellow, Carl Shapiro, and others said, no, absolutely not. This man wove genocidal anti-Semitism into his poetry, and most people would accept the Peas and Cantos, for example. But it was right for the Peas and Cantos that that Bellow went in his attack on Pound.
Pound had been committed to a hospital for the insane after the anti-American, anti-Semitic broadcasts he made during World War II.
Yes, but Bellow was also furious in his attacks on the genteel, judicious anti-Semitism of T.S. Eliot, as well as the rabid anti-Semitism. This didn't keep him from admiring as the art of certain anti-Semites. Céline yielded to nobody in his genocidal anti-Semitism, but Céline was a very important writer for Saul Bellow, as for many American writers, Philip Roth, for example. It's complicated.
Here's just a bit from his letter to Saul Bellow's letter to William Faulkner on Ezra Pound. He says, if sane, he should be tried again as a traitor. If insane, he ought not to be released merely because he's a poet. Pound advocated in his poems and in his broadcast enmity to the Jews and preached hatred and murder. Do you mean to ask me to join you in honoring a man who called for the destruction of my kinsmen? I wonder, Gloria, how William Faulkner received that straight up letter from his fellow writer.
I think he must have been quite shocked, because that anti-Semitism that ranged all through the great writers, it's in Fitzgerald, it's in Cather, it's in Faulkner, it's in Henry James even, it must have shocked him to be held to account for it, because it was almost a reflex among those WASP writers. And remember, it wasn't until 1950 that Jews finally made it into the mainstream of the American literary mainstream. And, you know, WASPs have not dominated the American literary mainstream since. But, you know, Bellow, he denied for a short period of time, shorter than most people think, his Jewishness, because he didn't want to be pigeonholed as a Jewish American writer.
Denied it in what setting, Gloria? As a child? As a young man? When? Where?
No, as a young man, painful family history. And after that, on his own terms, he very steadily reclaimed a great deal of his Jewishness, not ritual Jewishness, but his identification and his even public acknowledgement of his identification as a Jew. But yes, I think Faulkner would have been totally shocked and had to rethink himself on that one.
Do you have any sense, Benjamin? Is there a response from Faulkner in the letters that the family gave you, in the Bellow letters? Did he ever come back on this point?
There is not a response, and I don't think one ever existed. That's the sort of thing that would have been kept, and it's not in the archives. You also have to allow for the possibility of telephone calls, which were the great enemy of letter writing.
Right, but maybe it was time for a conversation by the time it got
there,
to that point.
Perhaps there was a conversation on the phone. I don't know.
Benjamin Taylor, my father calls in during this break to say that I actually met Saul Bellow along with Carl Sandburg on Sandburg's farm in North Carolina back in the 60s. I was a tiny tot indeed.
Huh.
Is there any correspondence with Sandburg here? Any mention of Sandburg? They're both big Chicago figures.
They are, and there's no mention of Carl Sandburg that I have come across in the letters. No, there isn't, interestingly enough. There another Chicago figure, Nelson Algren, is mentioned, but always as an antagonist. They tried to have dinner together once and didn't get past the soup.
That's as far as it went. Well, something was going on there on the farm with the goats. I do remember them, the goats. And Carl Sandburg, and, well, Saul Bellow, I guess, as well. Nathan Englander joins us right now from Iowa City, Iowa. Novelist, short story writer. He was recently selected to one of the New Yorker's 20 writers for the 21st century. Nathan Englander, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've written The Ministry of Special Cases and For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, and you've dipped into Saul Bellow's letters. What did you find there, Nathan?
What I found is an education, simply. I mean, my copy is chewed up and dog-eared and underlined, and to be able to read through a writer's life this way across time was unbelievable for me.
And what leapt out to you? Was it what gripped you most? Was it his correspondence with other writers? Was it his correspondence with his wives? It wasn't all pretty.
The psychological, straight up, for sure. I mean, again, it's thinking of writers' different role in America in the time, but in our very much reality TV world, where I think there's, you know, a lack of privacy and a lack of shame, but it's really different than an honest, brutal, thoughtful exploration of self. I mean, you know, it's what Benjamin said at the top of the show about knowing what he had in him. It's really deeply vulnerable and raw to just admit this belief in himself and to be, I mean, he was just so honest. I said brutal already, but just with others and with himself. And to me, just watching him change over time was absolutely fascinating.
You know, here he is, the great Saul Bellow, the Nobel Prize and all the rest. Is it intimidating to see his private thinking at work, or does it somehow look like lattice work to you as a younger writer?
Well, I guess it's just, I guess it was just, again, you know, I had exposed to the fiction first. So to see, I already thought the fiction is brave and, you know, it's just, it bulldozes ahead, those novels. It's, you know, they just race forward and he does not stop. But to see how, again, I already said the word vulnerable, but how personal it was, I feel like it was seeing how his synapses fires. And I feel like it's the way his head spun around, and to see him committing to it in his letters and his personal life, that to me, I guess it was just about how to work. And especially, I think mostly, it was seeing how he wasn't afraid to use the raw material of life, and that raw material being other people's lives. I mean, I think my favorite letter in the book, and Benjamin, who I know has them memorized, can tell us who it's to, but one of them is a friend clearly was wildly offended to find personal stories used by Bellow in one of the novels, like clearly some secret he told him that Bellow used in the letter. Bellow just says to him, he goes, "I give you my life. Take every story I've told you and you use it." And then he says to him, he goes on and says to him, "Are you angry that I use your story, or are you angry that I made something beautiful out of it?" And to me, that kind of just raw honesty, I mean, he writes these people, again, you see he keeps these friendships, but I feel like he can be so straight and then comes around and, you know, generally closes out after your entrails are laying on the table, even says to you, "I say this to you because you're a brother or you're a friend or because you mean a lot to me," and it seems sincere and was received as such.
Wow, Gloria, I mean, talk about a writer's correspondence. You take the stories, which writers, of course, do and must do, and turn them into art, and then a fellow writer calls you on it. That's a harsh interaction, Gloria, but that is the heart of what writers have to do.
I think so. And you know, it must have been tough to be Bellow's friend, to be his editor, to be a lover, to be one of his kids. There's a wonderful letter in here to Pascal Covici, and they've had a big difference over one of the books that obviously Covici's not too happy with. And he starts out his letter, "Sand and poison, eh? Look, Pat, let's not make baby talk. I'm not one of your money writers, and whatever you and Henry decide will be acceptable." And then he goes down to the end, and he says he doesn't want any Madison Avenue double talk. "But consider my pride as a workman. I'm not unqualifiedly enthusiastic about everything I write." And then he finishes it off, "As for the advance, I'm not one of your four-star generals weighted to the balls with medals and prestige. Nevertheless, you haven't lost much dough on me yet." And then he finishes it with this wonderfully affectionate phrase. "It's you, old bat. If I didn't love you like a parent, I'd never get so worked up."
It's pretty great. He could be so effusive and warm, telling Martin Amis to consider him sort of an adoptive father, telling Philip Roth that he knew Roth's stories were the real thing. In this great line, "When I was a little kid," he wrote to Roth, "there were still blacksmiths around, and I've never forgotten the ring of a real hammer on a real anvil." I mean, Nathan, to have that kind of endorsement from Saul Bellow when you're coming up in the world, that must really have helped send Roth, you know, I mean, not that he needed it, but talk about a boost.
Yeah, and I feel like Roth speaks about him sweetly that way. I feel like I was going to say there are meaner businesses in the world. I think that those intergenerational connections are so lovely and do, you know, there's different kinds of confirmation, but I do think, you know, however much, you know, Philip probably knew in the same way what he had in him, I do think those things are something, you know, totems, things that you can really hold on to.
Benjamin, can you recall who it was that was writing to complain to Bellow and he responding, you know, saying, "Hey, you take my life, make art of it if you will, use it"?
It was his dear old friend, Dave Peltz, who may be listening in Chicago. It was a wonderful story incorporated into Humboldt's gift really one of the ornaments of that book, and the book could not have done without the story, and
we're completely titillated now. Can you tell us a little? Give us some idea what the personal story was that he incorporated.
Actually, it's something that I can't tell on the air. people who know that novel will know that what I'm talking about is something that takes place in a men's room, he says also in that letter that Gloria has mentioned, the name of the game is give all, just before he says, you're welcome to anything in my life if you can make use of it. And then he says, I have the gift of making gold out of dross. So it's a very proud letter, but it is written with great love. And I don't think it ended that friendship by any means.
Let's get a call from Lexington, Kentucky. Dan, you're on the air.
Hello. I had a personal experience I thought I might share. I went to high school at the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools, and in 1967, Saul Bellows spoke to my high school English class, which was quite an honor, and he said something that I have never, ever forgotten. He told us, he said, I am a writer, and that means I sit at my typewriter 8 hours a day, and if I stare at a blank piece of paper or it ends up in the wastebasket, I've had an unproductive day, but I write every day. And that affected me very strongly. I'm not a writer, never would be a writer, but it made me realize how hard he worked and that one has to work hard at anything to succeed.
So it gave you maybe the work ethic, if not entirely the gift, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, that's true. It was a different... not only work ethic, but I think it changed the way that I look at literature and theater and dance and visual arts, whatever, the understanding that artists don't just wait for inspiration to strike them.
That's great. I appreciate your call so much, Dan, and lucky you for being there. One more, Winchester, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air, Richard.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you know?
It's been quite a while since I read Herzog, but as I recall, Mr. Taylor, there were letters sprinkled throughout that novel, and I wanted to find out, did you notice or feel any similarity to some of those letters that Bella wrote? I guess a majority of them in Herzog were letters to people that had offended him, and I realize there was a lot of heartfelt letters in the anthology that you've collected, but did you see any similarities or parallels at all?
That exasperated Herzog, writing letters to everybody. How about it, Benjamin Taylor?
The letters in the collected letters are all letters that were sent. The letters in Herzog are all letters that were not sent, and many of the letters in Herzog are to the dead, to people like Spinoza, for example, to his mother, or to God, inherently unsendable letters, visionary letters. So what fascinates me about Herzog is this wonderful conceit for a novel, a man who in his desperation, in the midst of a breakdown, is driven to write letters that become ever less sendable. None are sent, but they become ever less sendable and ever more exalted. And that's the spine of that novel.
Gloria, do you see the traces of Herzog's exasperation, sort of umbrage at the modern world in the real life letters of Saul Bellow, or side of the
not
pond?
Not really. I think one of the big mistakes that readers and scholars make is they read the Bellow characters to find Bellow. Of course, the voice is there, and the wittiness is there, and the content, the thematics. But they are very literary letters, and Bellow often said he talked to his dead, and he talked to himself and his characters all the time. And those are written letters. These ones have more the feel of spoken letters, the Benjamin's collection. So I would just caution against conflating the voices and the content of the two. Occasionally the politics resonate, occasionally the worldview resonates, but he's not mostly writing about that in these letters.
Let's go to Nick in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for such a wonderful topic, and thank you, Mr. Taylor, for such a wonderful collection. I picked it up last week. I'm a doctoral student currently working on a dissertation on Bello, on cannibalizing Bello, as he might himself have said. And I'm interested in this quote that you read from one of his letters to Cheever, in which you said, you mentioned the moronic pride of Southern traditionalists. And one of the topics I find most interesting about Bello's life is his unlikely cohabitation and friendship with something of a Southern traditionalist, Robert Penn Warren. So I just wanted to ask you, Mr. Taylor, what your thoughts were on this very sort of unlikely partnership.
I'm glad you mentioned Robert Penn Warren, a writer Bello loved and a writer Bello nominated twice for the Nobel Prize in Literature.
And certainly a Southern writer.
And a Southern writer, though a Southern writer who had broken with the agrarians, mm-hmm. and I think that's all important. But there was a kind of filial piety there, because when Bello went to the University of Minnesota right after World War II, there was Robert Penn Warren, a man of uncommon grace and charm and fabulous intelligence, who had just had a tremendous success, All the King's Men. And Bello was in awe of this man who treated him as an equal. And you have to understand that for many of these Jewish writers of that generation, they had had very little contact with people who weren't Jews. And I think Robert Penn Warren may have been the first non-Jewish friend that Bello had. In any case, Robert Penn Warren meted out great generosity and warmth to the young Bello, treated him as an equal. And this was very important to his formation, I think.
His later years teaching at Boston University, living in our backyard here just across the way in Brookline, Massachusetts. You've got the last letter in the collection, Benjamin Taylor. I wonder if you'd read for us. This is to Eugene Kennedy in February 2004.
From Brookline, I should say that Saul Bello and Janice Friedman Bello had a daughter in 2000. Her name is Rosie Bello, and hello, Rosie, if she's listening. Mm. He writes to his great friend, Eugene Kennedy, "I don't do much of anything these days, and I spend much of my time indoors. By far my pleasantest diversion is to play with Rosie, now 4 years old. It seems to me that my parents wanted me to grow up in a hurry and that I resisted, dragging my feet. They needed all the help they could get. They were forever asking, 'What does the man say?' And I would translate for them into heavy-footed English. That didn't help much either. The old people were as ignorant of English as they were of Canadian French. We often stopped before a display of children's shoes. My mother coveted for me a pair of patent leather sandals with an elegantissimo strap. I finally got them. I rubbed them with butter to preserve the leather. This is when I was 6 or 7 years older, little older than Rosie is now. Amazing how it all boils down to a pair of patent leather sandals. I send an all-purpose blessing. Saul."
February 2004. Nathan Englander, you're the next generation. Will you write letters? Do you write letters like this to friends, to fellow writers?
I actually want to make it my official, sign off is this wonderful. Yeah, I write tons of letters, but you're always drowning. Actually, I have the quote, but it's when Bello's brother dies, he said, "I should have written you a letter. It was too late to make the deaths of my brothers as an excuse. Since they died, I wrote a book. Why not a letter?" And to me, that's like, again, I think it's the same battle and ever increasing the digital world, which is writing, keeping up with the correspondence and keeping your head down in your next book. Yes.
And that humanity, even sometimes grandeur, will we find it in emails?
I think, yes, maybe in emails, but with worse spelling.
Well, there's a spelling, I guess, will be the least of it. I hope you do it, Nathan, you and everybody in your generation, because what a window it is to be able to go back and see these. Nathan Englander, joining us from Iowa City, Iowa, author of The Ministry of Special Cases for the Relief of Unbearable Urges. Great to have you with us. And Gloria Cronin, co-editor of the Saul Bellow Journal, joining us today from Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. It's just been great to have you with us, Gloria. Thank you so much for taking the time there.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you to Benjamin for such a remarkable collection of letters, such hard work.
Thank you, Gloria.
Benjamin Taylor, editor of Saul Bellow Letters. Benjamin Taylor, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.